Okay, good morning. So, first question. Did you all get the messages that went to the discussion board?
Yeah, I was sad. Very sad.
Sorry, not after the break. But if you wanted a day earlier...
There's a day later. There's like the 3,004 and then the 3,804 picture.
A day later is stupid. Yes. It's just a day. So you had a day ahead, not a day later.
No, the trouble is... As a general rule, you don't want to have people taking it afterwards. You want people taking it before, because basically most people will have taken it on the main day. So if you have it before, afterwards, then it's like you have the stragglers. So.
All of this is just that month between seconds.
Right, but why didn't you tell us in the first week or two of the semester? You weren't thinking? I mean, it's not like this is an unknown date. It was set on the first day of class. It was there. And I asked you, are you sure this is an okay date for things? I mean, go back to the recordings and you can see that I asked you, are you sure this is a good time for the midterm?
Yeah,
but that's what I'm asking. What else would I be asking? Is that a good day for you? Is that, were you planning on taking a vacation that day?
The 23rd.
No. Yes?
Are there tutorials this week?
No.
There is no tutorial on Monday, because of course the university is closed. There is an optional tutorial on Friday. If you want help with the homework, you don't have to show up, but the TAs will be there on Friday if you have questions. Yes?
Is assignment 5 finalized yet?
So it is basically finalized. I just want to make have someone do a proper bug check to make sure I haven't done anything really stupid. In particular, I know the answer I expect on the on the page size question, but I just want someone to check that for me. So that question on page sizes. So a segment can be any size, right? A segment can be any size. What is the size of a page? Because it has certain constraints. What's the constraints? How do you use a page size? Remember, you have a
virtual address, and then you have a physical address. So you have a virtual and the physical address. So if you're talking about a segment, and trying to create a segment to the absolute address, you have to do this arithmetic operation. You have to add the base address to whatever the offset is, and you have to do some combination. One key advantage when you're dealing with virtual and physical addresses, when we're dealing with pages, is that we don't have to add. What do we do instead? This is what plays all the constraints. So what you have in a physical address is there's a certain property that's the offset. You say this is the frame number. Here we have offset. And we have page number. These are the upper bits. It's a little loud there.
So these are the upper bits,
and these are the lower bits. So how do you go from here to here? The page number gets mapped to the frame number. This is via the page number. This is what the page table tells us. It
maps the page number, the frame number.
So, yeah, I saw that on the, how did, like, just as address conversion?
This is a lookup operation, the data structure. We haven't talked in detail about how this data structure is arranged, but you can first approximation, it's a table, or a hash table, if you want to think of it. Practice it's implemented as a hierarchical tree using a few tricks, whatever. But you got a page number and you map it to the frame number. So that's those bits are chained. What about the offset? What do you do with the offset?
Nothing.
It's just copy. This is copy.
Well, not, and of course, if you're doing the translation on the inside the processor, when you have this copy, you actually don't even have to copy. What you mean is you just have the wires from here go straight to here, and they are the same. And this has to be dealt with some of your complex hardware, but this is just, okay, that's the offset. Ooh, you got it.
So in order for this work, in order for this mapping to work, what constraint do we have to place on the size of this offset and the size of this page? Well, there's larger and smaller, but there's also, when can I just move this over here, like using wires on the CPU? This is where bits matter. This has to be a power of 2, and this has to be a power of 2. Otherwise, you don't have this clean boundary in the land of bits. What we're really saying is this page offset is some number of bits, like 101, and this will get put into 101. But this will be 11001210. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This could be 0000. Actually, these don't even have to be the same length. The physical address size and the virtual address size don't have to be the same. But the offset has to be the same number of bits. So this is some arbitrary mapping of the page number to the frame number. But the offset is just a copy. So this is in bit land. So since we're trying to get some number of bits here going from some number of bits there, that's why whenever you see powers of 2, you should think we're doing things at bit of boundaries, at bit level boundaries. That this is where the bits actually matter. So the offset, and correspondingly the page size, or the frame size, which are always equal, that's a what? Power of 2. 2K, 4K, 8K, 16K, 4 meg, it's whatever. Doesn't matter, but it's a power of 2. Because as long as it's the power of 2, we're talking bit boundaries.
So why do computer scientists traditionally like things like hexadecimal when doing things like addresses? Normally, when you see addresses, pointers, and stuff, they'll be represented in hexadecimal, not in decimal. First answer is not because computer scientists are masochists. Why do you want hexadecimal? So by doing base 16 versus base 10, yes, the alphabet's larger, but it doesn't change the numbers you can represent. It's just how you write it down. See, when you talk about hexadecimal versus decimal representation, it's just how we read it. It's not changing how it's stored inside the computer. But there's something more correct about doing things in hexadecimal when you're talking about computers. Yes?
It's just easier to read because you group the binary.
Exactly. A hexadecimal digit corresponds to 4 bits. How many bits correspond, because it's base 16, that's 2 to the 4.
many bits does base 10 represent? It's somewhere between 8 and 16, right? So it's a fractional bit. That's all messy. Decimal is not the native base of a computer. It should be a, you know, the native base is power of 2, it's base 2, but base 16 maps perfectly to base 2. That's also why you see octal. You see octal digits because that also maps. That's 3 bits. 3 bits versus 4 bits. The compromise is when you use 3 bits, you don't have to use these weird things that are normally not numbers like A through F, but you get this reduced rate. When you use decimal, when you use hexadecimal, then you know, it represents 4 bits. And it's a little cleaner. Same thing. Page size and offsets are, you know, the range of the offsets is a power of 2. It's not any particular offset will not be a power of 2 because it has a full range. I'm saying that the storage used to encode an offset is a power of 2.
So the page size is
the page size determines the range of the offset. I mean, the offset could be 17. Be 59. It's a particular, when we say offset, we're saying that we're talking about a specific byte in the page. But what's the range of the bytes that can go in a page? That's the size of the page. For example, classic x86 32-bit pages are 4K in size. So what's the range of offsets for a 4K page? It's from 0. 4K is 4096. So the offsets are from 0. 4095. Okay? Questions? So another thing that you'll need for the assignment is it's a question that refers to Peterson's algorithm. I suggest you look at the algorithm a bit in the book. But the main thing to know about Peterson's algorithm is that it doesn't work on modern machines. And we talked a bit about this, but the big idea is, you know, it's the memory hierarchy. You're going to ask me later about this, fine, but a key assumption of the Peterson's algorithm is that when one processor writes to memory, the other processors will see that write and see that current value.
Is that true? Modern system?
No. So now I want to talk about concurrency mechanisms. So we started talking about locks.
Locks.
There's all these things called condition variables. And there's a thing called semaphores. You build all these using the same basic hardware mechanisms. Namely, you have the test and set, exchange, assembly instruction, which lets you do lets you check a value and change it in one atomic operation. That's the basic functionality from the hardware because we have to have all the CPUs synchronized on a certain memory location. So that's what these are all built out of. But the semantics are different though in these higher level constructs. They're not that high level, but they're certainly higher level than this raw assembly instruction. So when do you use what? What is the purpose of these things? Because it's a bit confusing, because if you look at the actual mechanisms, there's huge amounts of overlap. Because what you're always talking about with these things is some sort of, you have some sort of storage. So you have storage. That's the
maybe it's a, generally the storage is you have some storage with atomic operations. So you can check its value and change it all at one time. So we don't have race conditions and actually manipulating its value. And then we have a queue. You have a queue of threats, queue of entities waiting for it. You put out processes and stuff, but even if they have to share memory. So the difference between these is related to how you deal with the interaction between these. So if you have a lock, what happens is you now have someone has the lock you want to take the lock, grab lock. So you grab the lock and you release the lock. When you grab the lock, does grabbing the lock always, well, or does releasing the lock always succeed? Yes. If you have the lock and you release it, you release it. Done. Does grabbing the lock always succeed? No, it does not. So, grab, lock. And lock. When we talk about blocking, we mean it's going to sit there and wait for the condition to happen, and nothing else is going to happen to that threat until that condition is met. Now, there are these things. You often have a try lock. Try lock means check to see if the lock is grabbable or not. The main idea of the try lock is it will grab the lock if it's available, but if it's not available, it will return. It's non-blocking. Why do you want to have a non-blocking version? Because maybe you don't want to sit there and block. Maybe you want to go on and do something else. But most of the time when you're using locking code, you'll use the blocking version, you'll try to grab the lock, and when the grab the lock fails, it will wait until the grabbing the lock succeeds. So what happens if Ted, yes? Time lock? Oh, that's what we're dealing with deadlock. So whenever you talk about a timer on the lock, that means that you try it. Try lock means you try it. Is it available? No, return. If it's available, grab it, return. Scrab lock implies how long do I wait for the lock to become available? An infinite period of time. So what you can do is set timeouts for some kind of lock, some implementation. No, you don't know how long it should be locked for. What you're saying is I at most want to wait, say, 1 minute. Exactly. You don't normally hold the lock for a limited period of time. I'm not saying there aren't implementations of that, but that's not the normal case. Because that would cause all kinds of weird errors. Because all of a sudden you're doing your computation, you expect to have the lock, and all of a sudden it's released. That would be bad. No worries. So what if, say, five processes, you know, five threads, try to grab the lock all at once. Only one of them is going to succeed, right? What do the rest do? They're all blocked. They're all blocked. They're all waiting. There's two ways for them to wait. One is you can whip. One way to wait is to just go into an infinite loop. You just keep, you turn the try lock into a grab lock by putting this in an infinite loop. It just keeps trying until it succeeds. That is sometimes a good idea. That is used extensively in the Linux kernel. It's called a spin lock. Spinning. Round. If the CPU with running the spin lock is doing nothing else, the CPU is now useless until that succeeds because it's running an infinite loop. Not very good for making efficient use of resources. So if you ever have a spin lock, you use a spin lock because you expect the time for you to wait to be very small. And if you're talking about some small bit of data which only needs to be accessed briefly, maybe that makes sense. You know that no one's going to be using this, using the lock structure for very long. So instead of doing what I'm about to describe, it's better just to sit there and wait. I mean, it's just like if you're going to a government office and you want to have something, happen, you're probably going to have to wait in line, right? So when you're spin locking, you could say it's like you're sitting in the queue and you're doing nothing. But what you can also have instead is what we call a wait. And here we say they queue up. They wait. What this means is, like, you're freeing up the resources to do something else. So the particular processor that's running the thread, if it encounters something that a lock that has a queue behind it, lock's not available, it puts that thread to sleep. So what does it mean when we say we put a thread to sleep? What does sleep mean? Well, sleep means you're saying the thread goes to sleep. That implies something about the scheduling of the thread. No, it's not low priority. It's not running anymore. It means it is specifically kicked off any CPU it's running on. That's the point of it sleeping. When it's sleeping, it's saying, I am not going to consume any resources right now. I'm out of the running. When you wake up, so in biological terms, if you're talking about something sleeping, it's still consuming resources. But in computer terms, if something is sleeping, it's consuming no CPU resources. It's still consuming space resources. It's potentially still consuming RAM. Maybe still living in cache. But it's not being actively run by a core. So when you say a thread yields or a process yields, what it's really saying is, I don't need my CPU anymore. Here you go. I'm going to go sleep until some later time. That's exactly what it is. What you're doing when you call sleep is you're making a system call and you're sending a message to the kernel saying, I don't want to do anything. For some period of time, some number of seconds. I want to sleep for 10 seconds. That means you're taken out of the list of running processes. You're put on the list of blocked processes, basically. You're blocked on this event happening. And the event that you're waiting for is for a timer to go off. When the timer of 10 seconds, say, goes off, then your process is brought back in and is about to run. When you sleep for 10 seconds, you may actually sleep for longer. because of course it depends on the CPU. But in general, you'll go, you should sleep for at least that amount of time.
Does Cockroach Scheduler, like, say the process right now, like, a new process comes along using this CPU, like, how does it evolve?
Well, how does a new thread come in? No, so remember, when we're talking about locks, we're talking about multiple threads. So we're talking about sharing the same address space. Because all these locks only make sense in reference to this shared storage. Processes do not have shared storage. They have logically distinct copies of all storage, even if they're sharing read-only copies. It's logically separate copies. For threads, they share an address space. And they use this address space to coordinate their operations. So one thread comes along, it says, I try to grab the lock is not available. So it puts itself in the wait queue, basically. It queues up waiting for the lock. Let's say another thread comes along, and it wants the lock, it's not available. It then gets behind it in line. And you have this lined up, waiting to be serviced. When I say wait, I mean sleep. Wait equals sleep. Because you don't, if it's actually actively waiting, running on the CPU in an infinite loop, that's it spinning. You don't queue up with spinning. There's no queue if you're doing a spin lock. Because it's every core is just sitting there spinning. You have for five threads to be blocked on a spin lock. That means five threads have to be running on five cores at the same time, all running an infinite loop, waiting for that lock to become available. That's very expensive. You don't use spin lock for things that you expect to wait for very long at all, otherwise it's fast. But sometimes you want to use a spin lock rather than queuing up because it takes effort to actually put something to sleep and wake it back up. It takes some number of instructions. Change its process state, thread state, this whole data structure you have to update, change these things. You're now call the scheduler, something else is going to load in, so it's kicked out of memory, now you have to put it back in. It's a relatively expensive thing to bring out, to put a process to sleep, or put a thread to sleep, anything to sleep, and then have it wake up. You only expect it's going to be like 20 instructions that you'll have to wait. You might as well spin. Because it's going to probably take hundreds of instructions to put a process to put a thread to sleep and then wake it back up. Yes. When you put a thread to sleep, it potentially can involve a context switch. Because normally putting the thread to sleep, this depends on how threads are implemented. We haven't talked about this yet, but if you're talking about threads that are scheduled by the kernel, it involves a system call because you're going to sleep. And then it's not going to be a timer sleep, but you're going to wait for a condition to happen. You're going to go to sleep, and then you have to be woken back up. So, yeah, it involves context switches. At a minute, it's a relatively expensive operation, sleep. There's ways to make sleeping of threads cheaper. And this goes into different kinds of implementations of threads. But it's always going to be more expensive than the time it takes for a spin lock. But, again, it depends on how long the time is you're going to be waiting. If you're going to be waiting less than, say, the time required to execute 50 to 100 instructions or something, you probably want to do a spin lock. But if you're going to have to be waiting for a more significant period of time, then you're going to want to do it. So with a lock, all the threads queue up. Then, when the one that was active gets done, we treat this as a queue, first in, first out. You lined up first, you get service first. You get the lock next, and then you get the lock next, and you get the lock next. They take their turns. So a condition variable, if I drew this diagram for all of these, condition variable, same basic idea. We have a condition. The that we want to check. And we have wake queue.
But the difference is in how we treat the queue. The idea of a condition variable is saying, I'm waiting for something to happen. Like say, I'm waiting for a key to be pressed. I'm waiting for something to come in from the network. I'm waiting for something to happen. Or I'm waiting for this other thread, the other threads to have gotten so far in the computation. You're waiting.
So the idea is that what you're doing with the condition variable is you're checking, is that game? This isn't what the book says now, so I'm sort of saying it's informal and that you can see the mapping. But is condition, check condition, set condition.
And the check condition can be blocking or non-blocking. So instead of grabbing the lock, you want to set a condition. And I'm going to check the condition, seeing if this is true or not. So it seems kind of lock-like, right? It seems kind of the same. As we're setting this thing, we want to make sure we don't mess this up and things, but what's really happening here is your normal expected thing when you check for the condition is you normally don't do this. You normally do the blocking one, which basically means I'm going to sleep until the condition has happened. And the set condition says, it happened. Something happened. So if you turn your head sideways, you realize that doesn't seem that different from a lock. But the difference lies in how you treat the queue. With the lock, you're waiting for exclusive access to something. Maybe an entire data structure, a tree or something. You're saying, I want to make sure I have exclusive access to this. And so only one thread can access the resource at a time. We're enforcing mutual exclusion. We do not want to have concurrency. We want to have serial semantics. With a condition variable, I am not trying to enforce serial semantics. What actually I'm saying is when this condition happens, tell everyone. So with a lock, when you have the queue, everyone who's queued up is going to individually get their turn. With a condition variable, when you have this queue, when the condition becomes true, everyone wakes up. Everyone is in queue gets served. So instead of a FIFO, it becomes, hey, the whole gang, let's come to the party. What? Isn't that bad? Depends on what you're trying to do. Maybe there's some initialization routine that has to happen. Let's say you have a multi-threaded process. Let's say there's some initialization that has to happen. So you have maybe 64 threads that are running, but they have to wait on one thread to finish stuff. This initialization. Set up the whole thing, it's a serial process, so it's busy doing its work. But then once it's done, all the other threads should run. Say, so you have a condition. Is the initialization finished? And they all say, let's block until initialization's finished. And then one thread says, initialization finished. Then they all wake up and they start doing computation. So mechanism, basic pieces underlying are the same. You have to do some slight difference in implementation, but the semantics of it are fundamentally different. And it
semantic differences come from how you treat the queue. Are you going, is everyone in the queue going to get serviced one at a time, or are you just going to say everyone gets it? You want everyone gets it, you want a condition. You want one at a time, you're talking about blocking semantics. It's all everybody at once. I mean, it's, you say, think of a club. You know, it's like, are the doors open yet? The club. Wait until the doors are open. When the doors are open, everyone floods in. Versus sitting at the passport office saying, next. Next. So, party in one case, no party in the other case. Yes?
Okay. The book had mentioned one page of
in a concurrent application, you'll use these different constructs. It's not that you use just one. The locks are the most common, but you potentially will have this, because the locks are about, I mean, it's generally about protecting access to a data structure of some kind. While a condition variable is waiting for, is about some state of computation having been achieved. Some state of computation, or some state of the environment, or something. Something has come to pass. And so that's why I say it's a condition. Has the condition happened? That's the question. It's like, can, and the locks are saying, can I get exclusive access to the resource? Well, you, if there is some exclusive resource, like you could, if there's some exclusive resource that you don't want them accessing in parallel, it's going to have to be protected by a lock. So normally in code that uses condition variables, you'll see right beside it there'll be some mutex, some lock. So another word for lock you can say is mutex. Really? Mutual exclusion. Then there's this. Semaphores. So this is, so when we say, so what, oftentimes we talk mutex, they talk about binary semaphores. As you'll see, what we consider to be a lock is really a special case of a semaphore where the value of the variable can just be 0 or 1. But a general counting semaphore, the value of this can be 0, 1, 2, 3, can be any number. Integer. So it turns out you can use semaphores to implement both of these. Although using semaphores to implement condition variables is actually kind of tricky. It's possible to do, but depends on your building blocks on. But the idea of a semaphore is this is a number. So this is going to be like 5, 3, whatever. But it's counting a resource. So how many of you subscribe to Netflix? Not any of them. Wow. But So in these streaming type solutions, they have, generally you have a limit on the number of concurrent streams you can run off of your account. 1, 2, 3, sometimes you up it to 4 or something, but they have to keep track of how many streams you have currently running, and if you can run more than that, it has to lock you out. So the idea of a semaphore is saying, let's count the number of streams that are running currently. Exactly, max 3 threads or something like that. So let's say the standard value of this is 4. So what this means is that 4 threads can grab this can do the down operation. So the basic rule is decrement. So down blocks only if less than. Well, I think normally it's depends on the semantics of, this, of how exactly you run it. I think it's normally it's less than zero.
So,
okay, it's four. So this would be well, this would actually give me a five, right? I can go four. Four can go to three. Three can go to two. So three, two, one, zero. And get four. That will not, four threads will not block. They can all run the down operation. When the fifth thread runs it, it's going to block. Because all of a sudden now we've gotten to minus one. And now, so when the value of this is negative, it's actually counting the number of things that are, number of threads that are waiting on the semaphore. So it's minus one. Okay, now if you get down to minus three, that means three threads are running. And whatever the maximum value of this for it goes up. So when you say up, you increment it back up. So you can see a lock in this case is just this if you set the value to, you know, to one. It's a binary semaphore. So it's one, you decrement zero, one can get it, and then oh you've done more, now you're waiting. That's the thing now. See, this is, it's a weird kind of mix between a lock and a condition variable. Because what you're doing is, you're saying that instead of there being like one copy, one can be present. Really, a semaphore is like, okay, you have a, okay, you have a bathroom. Four people can use the bathroom at a time. Let's say you have something saying, okay, four people can use a bathroom, no one else. So when someone goes in, okay, four people are in there. Now someone's come out. Okay, now someone can go back in. Oh, wow. If the room's empty, then four people can go in. There's a certain number of resources. You can go in. Someone might take a really long time. Someone might not take a lot of time at all. You're just, but if it fills up, everyone's waiting. So in practice, if you're looking at how people build things, people use mutexes all the time. Condition variables, again, have very clear semantics. Semaphores are more of a building block that for doing certain kinds of algorithms, like, okay, I want to have only so many threads running at the same time or something. I mean, it's something that you can use, but it's kind of much harder to reason about. Okay, up to three can do this, and then 2, 1, 0, you know, go up to three. You have to be very careful with your downs and ups. It's just, I'm more telling you about semaphores just there. I'm probably not going to talk about them too much. Because again, they're confusing, but you should know about what they are. Right here. 5 minutes. I have it at
9:26. Let's get started.
So again, this whole thing of semaphores, look at it in the book. I'll talk about some more later, but if it doesn't make complete sense, do at least another read-through. I'm assuming you've all looked at the chapters, right? But go through and look at the chapter, try to understand it. Hopefully what I've said in class will help you kind of get a sense of what this material is. But concurrency is a tricky topic. And we are barely covering it here. I'm just covering enough concurrency
so that you can understand the basics of what's going on inside an operating kernel. But you can spend a long time doing concurrency.
So what's in the
midterm, the basic coverage in the midterm, is the assignments and the tutorial. The emphasis on the assignments. Yes? Which system calls are implemented with? So the key thing with pthreads is pthreads is designed to be portable across POSIX systems, so Unix compatible, Unix-like systems. The exact system calls that are used for this can vary in how it does it. But you're right, you need to have some sort of. So, okay, I take that back. So you want certain system calls are used, but actually when you do pthreads, a lot of times it's doing the actual low-level assembly. That's also present as well. Because that's what I'm saying. It's a mix of things. It can be both. It can be implemented partially in user space, and partially it can be implemented in kernel. And this is because you can actually have, you can switch between threads without involving the kernel. You can switch between the CPU states. We haven't, again, that's something a little more advanced. We haven't really talked about that. But the mapping between the low-level mechanisms and the API is non-trivial. You should get an idea of, yes, I can see how they can implement that API using mechanisms, but when you actually look at the code, you look at the pthreads implementation, it's surprisingly complex, especially if you look at the different versions. So the material, so the first, the five, you know, through assignment five is going to be on the midterm, right? That's how many assignments you've had. Those are the ones that are going to be there on the midterm. If you look at assignment five has bits and pieces from the lectures I've had last week and this next week. So we have lecture today, we have lecture Friday, and then we have lecture next week for two of them, and then the midterm. So are the lectures that, I would say the lectures I give this week can help you with parts of assignment five. Then there are the lectures that I'll give the week after, which will actually be back on virtual memory. And that will be expanding the notion. I'll be talking more about pages and stuff. But again, the assignments didn't test that exactly, the stuff in those last couple of lectures. But the details of that should help you with your conceptual understanding of what happened and deepen your understanding of the other things. Because what I tend to do in these questions, in these midterms, is I'll take the questions from the assignments, and you'll see a lot of recycling. There will be a lot of overlap between the midterm question, between the questions on the assignments and the questions on the midterm. But I also generally add some questions that check to see, have you gotten the appropriate conceptual model, get broaden things out of it relative to the assignments. You can't just come into the midterm and have memorized the answers to the assignments. If you come into the midterm and have memorized the answers to the assignments, but haven't actually worked through them and tried to figure them out, you're going to do very badly in general. You're probably going to fail. If you instead did the assignments and actually learned what was in there, made an honest attempt to figure out what was and went through the right process, when you come to the variations of the questions, you see on the midterm, you'll go like, oh, yeah, that's no problem. I don't try to make my midterms incredibly difficult. I try to make them relatively, I try to make them in line with what I've expected you to learn in the assignments and the tutorials. The reason why I do that is because, frankly, it's easy for me to write a midterm that you'd all fail. That's not hard. Operating systems is a big subject. There's lots of details. I can hook, and I can only cover so much of it in half a semester or a semester. There's going to be pieces of it that you won't completely understand. There's only so much I can teach you. So I have to guide you in what I'm covering. And even the textbook covers way more material than you're going to actually be able to understand in detail. Well, I'd say this textbook's better than most. So use the assignment as a guide. But if you have questions in the assignment, you go like, wow, I don't quite understand what's going on with this question. I kind of figured out an answer for this, but I really don't know what's going on there. That's the problem. You don't understand something. Use the assignment as a diagnosis of your mental model. If you have certain questions that you stumbled through and maybe kind of got an okay answer, maybe you kind of got an okay grade or whatever, that's telling you something. You don't understand something. Figure it out. Ask questions. You have to use the resources that you get. When you look at the solutions for the assignment and then you look at what you answered, you go like, this doesn't quite match. Something's missing in your head. So speaking of solutions, I should have solutions for assignment 3 and 4 up in the next day or two. And assignment 5, of course, will go up after assignment 5 is finished. So it's like in the next week. Questions? Yeah, assignment, solutions for 1 and 2 are already up. 3 I've just got about done, and 4. Yeah, 4 you just have turned in, so we'll get that up now.
Like in the midterm, like for assembly, are you going to ask us to like decipher like you did in the
assignment? So one thing I do keep in mind is that when you do the assignment, you have access to a lot of resources. You don't have access to those same resources when you do these, but I do expect you to have actually done it. So that means that, yeah, could there be some assembly on the midterm which you might actually have to figure out what the heck's going on with it? Yes. But I'm not expecting to have memorized every opcode. So what I might do is I might give you saying like, okay, here's this little bit of assembly. Here's what this instruction's doing. Have a little translation of the opcode maybe a bit. Or maybe using opcodes that I expect you to have seen multiple times. But, yeah, no, I know that you'll have access to the full resource of the internet when you're doing the assignment. You don't have that. You should retain something. You should have a basic idea how this assembly language works and this whole moving around instructions and setting things. Changing things like stack pointers and base pointers and stuff. You should have figured out the basics of that. So you should have some rough idea of how things work. You look at a line of assembly. That was the point of the exercise. Like you look at a bit of assembly and you don't just go, oh, it's gobbledygook. Do I expect you to be fluent in exactly what's going on? No. I expect you to understand every bit of it? No. There are certain pieces of it that I ask you to pay particular attention to. Or, more importantly, you should know the patterns that you saw in assembly so I can ask you higher level questions about it. Like, for example, what's the real use of the segment registers when you're doing things in assembly? That's for doing things like controlling access to the stack and controlling access to local variables. Remember what it does with the stack pointer and the base pointer? You saw that, right? The local variable part. Make space with local variables, but then what register do you use to access the local variables? Do you use the stack pointer as the offset? It copies it to the base pointer, the base register. And it uses the base register The stack pointer uses the base register offset. That way, that's where you access your local variables. For example. Now, I will, since this is a question I asked in the assignment, you will see the full answers and you'll be able to study that, but that's the kind of thing to learn. And if you don't get it, ask questions. Fair enough? So, if you see something on the test, you're like, wow, that wasn't covered in the assignments or anywhere, then you go like, then you can come after and kind of go like, wait, what are you talking about? But it's all there, but the stuff in the assignments is, some of it can be a little deep. Okay, what was it? Oh, sorry. So these are all building blocks. What do you use to build? One classic thing is all these data structures and things, and again, we're not going to go through all that. A lot of those aren't really so necessary. The first approximation, what mostly happens in the kernel, is you have some sort of tree or struct or something, and you want to make sure that there isn't concurrent access to it because you'll corrupt the data structure, so you put a lock on it and you release the lock when it's available. And you have lots of these locks because you want to maximize parallelism. Remember, if it's just a single lock, then everyone has to wait a lot. If there's smaller ones, then divide everyone into multiple lines. And you have less waiting. I have to cover producer-consumer. That's one of those standard problems. And also, it's actually particularly relevant and also illustrates a lot of concepts. So when I think of when you think of producer-consumer, you should think of a pipe. So when I talk about a pipe, I'm saying on the command line. Remember, you could do these things like sort. So you have a file foo. Standard command line on Unix is sort. So what we'll do, it'll sort the lines of the file. And then this thing unique removes any duplicates it finds. So if you do sort unique, you'll get a list of all the unique lines in the document. If I had another command to add in line breaks for every word, I could actually get a list of all the unique words in the document. So this pipe operator says you take the standard output from this program and make it the standard input for this program. Why am I talking about this in producer-consumer? It's one thing to do IO redirection with files. But when you're talking about pipes, you're talking about processes. And when you talk about processes, you think, well, this is the one on the left side of the pipe is the producer. So sort foo is a producer for this. Unique is a consumer. It's taking whatever sort foo produces and doing something with it. You start looking at pipes, you can all say, well, there's another consumer with, but yeah.
Can you use two pipes?
What, sorry. The pipe operation does not work on a file. It's between processes. I could have said, instead of say sort foo, I could have said like, let's say cat. And say cat foo, and then pipe that to sort, pipe that to unique. But really, that's kind of a little silly. But No, actually, no, I take that back. Instead of saying cat food, you could say LS.
Sort
unique.
Yes, the pipe operator is the vertical bar that's sitting in between. Yes?
Is the pipe just like taking the input from one thing and like the output from one thing?
Exactly. But it can. So this thing like LS is. LS, you know, you always think of it as terminating. But you could do something that produces.
I can do something like cat.
Yeah. Well, that probably I'll probably have to stick something in there to actually make it into text. Which I can't think off the top of my head what a good command is. But you did something like cat dev random. So dev random is something that produces random number. This doesn't stop.
Could you represent that like you can also do the function called.
This is how it's represented in the Unix shell.
So you can put like the cat
inside the bracket. No. This is important to realize. This is Unix shell notation. On the left is what's the output, and on the right is what's the input. So notice here, this cat dev random is giving output to sort, it's taking that as input, and then it's outputting that to unique. That's a neat thing about pipes, is you can chain them together on the command line. And it doesn't, don't think of this as processing a file. These do not necessarily run to completion. These can be infinite things. They can produce arbitrary amounts of data, and you can just keep going. Let's say you use things for, like, this cap could be of a log file that's being constantly produced by some program. Let's say a web, you know, a web thing. And then that can be passed to, oh, yeah, so like a... You do something stupid like, this is good. Yeah, but the trouble is sort doesn't really work well for that because it has to actually have the whole input sorted. So it will only produce output once its input is closed. You have to buffer it. So that's why it's all over. Yeah. Anyway, so the point of this is you, in general, with a pipe, cannot expect the input to be completely done before the output does anything. Oh. I'm being stupid. So what you do is so let's say we take the messages that are coming out of our syslog. Actually, this probably won't actually work that well because this might. This will just. Let's see. Tail-f. When you say tail-f for a file, it means show me the last lines of the file and keep showing them. Don't stop. So it'll keep checking the file for more things. Now, this is constantly giving you the messages here. You might say, okay, that's fine. You know, these are coming out. But then what I could do is that's a better one. Thank you. Grep 4. I want to find all the messages that are coming up involving the user and nil. So this is a tail-f/var/log/syslog. So this is now producing messages. And now I've put this to a pipe, and this graph of nil means that this will only output lines that have my name in it, of these four characters. This will run continuously. This won't ever stop. It'll just keep outputting. So if this is happening, you should realize there has to be some sort of coordination happening between these processes. Tail is running continuously. Rep is running continuously. How do they know? Do they just keep, is this thing busy waiting? Is this thing constantly cycling, just waiting? No. Is grep constantly saying, oh, is there input? Is there input? Is there input? No. There's not. But is it every character that comes out of tail, does each character get processed by grep? And then it goes, oh, here's one character. Oh, here's one character. Oh, here's one character. Is that how these are interacting? That would be really dumb. We want these to be coordinated. We want the output of this to go to the input of this program, but we don't want to have it be such that every byte of output from one is instantly given to the input of the other. If you did that, that would be horribly inefficient. So what do you do instead? No, that is exactly what happens. The file descriptor of one becomes a file descriptor of the other. But in the kernel, it has to control the relative rates of how fast these run. Like, for example, let's say a whole bunch of messages come in really fast from the logs. Can grep necessarily keep up with this? Tail could run really fast, and grep could fall behind. Or grep could run really fast and is always waiting for the input of tail to come in. It wants to run as soon as it comes out. So there's this coordination problem of the producer may run faster or the consumer may run faster. And whichever one is running faster, you have to coordinate. So if the producer runs too fast for the consumer, you may actually want to put the producer to sleep and say, wait, hold on, we're not ready for you. And if the consumer runs too fast, you want it to run for a while, and then you want to put it to sleep until the producer has actually produced something. There's no point in grep running while tail hasn't produced anything recently. And tail should not keep running if grep cannot keep up. It should be paused. There's no need for it to keep running. This is the producer-consumer pattern. And in order for this producer-consumer pattern to work, you have to use condition variables and locks. And so that's what we're going to talk about now. What do you mean those condition variables and locks? Wow, we're almost out of time. So the key idea here is that you have some storage between these. You aren't having these interact on a byte going back and forth. What you have instead is a buffer. The buffer can be arbitrarily sized. It can potentially grow and shrink. But the main idea is that you don't just take the output of the producer and give it straight to the consumer. You buffer it up. You let the producer produce for a while. Then the consumer can consume for a while. So you have this and you could say, and normally what you think of the buffer is it's a circular list. So this goes around. So when you get to the end, you start at the beginning. And you have to have something of noting where you are in this. But we have the producer working here. You have the consumer working here. So the producer's filling stuff up. Well, let's say the producer's... So the producer just filled this up. It already, let's say it's going left to right. It already did this one. And now, let's say now this one's now working on this. So the producer is over here. It's produced these three things. It had produced here, but the consumer's here. It already ate it. The consumer's constantly following the producer. So you have to make sure that you guarantee exclusive access. First off, you have to have a mutex to make sure they don't write, you know, they don't step on each other in this. The mutex you could, the simplest mutex you can have is just for the entire data structure. Mutex for, but you could do it finer grain. You could have multiple mutex. You could have a mutex for each little part of the buffer if you wanted to. But the easiest way is you just have a mutex for the buffer. This is to make sure they both aren't messing with this at the same time. Because if they mess with it at the same time, they'll potentially steal data, and who knows who's doing what. This might be, you could even part one could partially consume it and partially produce it in one spot. Bad. Oh, no, there's two things. So you have to have a mutex for the buffer, and then you have to have a condition. You have to have a condition producer waiting, and you have to have the consumer waiting. That's the general solution size of the way the solution works, because the consumer can come along and say, hey, there's nothing in the buffer for me to consume. It goes to sleep. And basically what it says is, it goes to sleep and it says the consumer's waiting. And so when the producer starts producing, it has to wake up the consumer. And similarly, if the producer goes along and say, hey, I filled up the buffer. There's no room for me to produce anything. I'm going to go to sleep. And so when the consumer starts consuming, it needs to wake up the producer and say, hey, I've started consuming, there's room for you to go back to work. So you have to, in general, the solution to this involves two condition variables and a mutex. Okay, and I'll stop there. We can go a bit more.